we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
In the West, the Bible has been used to rationalise political positions and to justify all kinds of policies. This is perhaps the most recent example.
Illegal entry into the United States is a crime. It should be, it must be, if you're going to have a legal system and have any limits whatsoever. Persons who violate the law of our nation are subject to prosecution. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
That was U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions in June of this year, quoting from Romans 13 to justify his government's policy of separating children from their migrant parents at the U.S. border. It was a shocking policy, and it was reversed after a swell of public outrage not only in the US, but all over the world. And there was also outrage over the use of the Bible to justify it.
There were a lot of political commentators talking about this, of course, but also Christian leaders, pastors, priests, who got invited on primetime US news shows to weigh in on Sessions' Bible reading skills. Here's Jensen Franklin on CNN. He's a church pastor in Georgia and a member of President Trump's Evangelical Advisory Council.
Yeah, I just think that it's a very dangerous route to go when you begin to take selections of scriptures and say the Bible was written to justify political standings. The Bible was never written as a political roadmap.
And here's Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest on MSNBC, talking about how Sessions was out of line to pull the Bible into the debate in this way.
And I think what they're doing is it's called proof texting, which is you take a verse of the Gospels or the Old Testament out of context and just sort of throw it at people, almost weaponizing the Gospels and the Bible. Attorney General Sessions' reference to Romans 13, we should be clear, in terms of following the law, has been used to support slavery and also was used by the Nazis as well. And so you cannot take these Bible verses out of context and just throw them about like that. It's very dangerous.
Actually, this habit of appealing to the Bible for political purposes is more widespread than you might think. On the left and on the right, not just in the US, but in the more secular UK and here in Australia. Someone who's been noticing and has written a book about it is Nick Spencer. He's director of research at Theos Think Tank in the UK, and he was in Australia recently to deliver CPX's annual lecture, the Richard Johnson Lecture. We sat down to ask him about his latest book, The Political Samaritan, How Power Hijacked a Parable, which tackles the political uses of maybe the most famous story Jesus told. But first, we start with the broader question. Can politics and religion ever mix well?
The old edict in the UK is that there are certain conversations you avoid around a dinner table. One is politics, the other is religion. So seeing as I write on politics and religion, I don't get invited to dinner very much.
No, I can imagine. Or if you do, people are very nervous when you turn up. But why is that? Why is it such a difficult thing to have these conversations when really they're very important human questions? Mm.
So I think the classic reason is politics is supposed to be about compromise. Religion is supposed to be about not compromising and being certain, and combine the two and it's explosive. In actual fact, of course, it's so much more complicated and subtle than that. But historically, there are quite good reasons for that.
Now, were I to invite you to a dinner party, and we did bring up the subject, how would you then approach that if not in the way you've described?
I think one of the best ways of approaching it is, what's your vision of a good life? What kind of society do you want to live in? What kind of person do you want to be remembered for being? Both of those, or all of those really, are profoundly, in their own way, political and religious questions. And we're less anxious about talking about that. We're less anxious talking about, you know, how things are going and why we might be dissatisfied with how things are going and the kind of things we'd like to see and the kind of person we want to be. So it's introducing visions of the good into conversations, means you end up talking, or you can end up talking about politics and religion without heading straight for the neuralgic issues.
It's interesting to me that you get, for instance, Christian believers on both sides of politics who are very committed to quite different visions.
Mm.
That can be difficult too.
It really can. I remember doing a literary festival about 6 or 7 years ago, and I'd just written the book on the history of the Bible and politics. And I concluded the book by saying, that's one of the big objections people have. But in actual fact, as in big objections, as in all religious believers being corralled into one end of the political spectrum, in actual fact, anything who knows anything about politics finds them across the spectrum. And that actually is in some regards a bigger problem. Not that they're across the spectrum, but because they're across the spectrum without having thought through the theological implications. And they're just kind of picking up the existing positions. And I said that, you know, I'd actually like them to be better informed theologically. As it happens, in Literary Festival, the person who was doing the Q&A said, you know, this is what you appear to be suggesting. Is that right? And I made the rookie error of answering a straight question with a straight answer. And I just said, yes. And there was a sharp intake of breath from one corner of the audience. I couldn't work out what had offended them so much. And I realised subsequently what they had heard me saying was that, therefore, all Christians should be one particular political position, which wasn't what I was saying. But it was an indication to me of that hair-trigger sensitivity there is around what you could put in inverted commas as religious right-style politics.
And did you think of a really good answer on the way home in the car?
You always do. It was days afterwards for me, but yes.
Now, there's a kind of weird lingering Christianity in some parts of Australian politics, British politics, despite the kind of speed of secularisation. It's still there, isn't it, in a strange way?
It is. And I would go further than lingering, actually. I mean, it's actually there more prevalently than you would think. It's not in the same way as, you know, if you go back in the UK 100 years or so ago, church or chapel would be another way of asking whether you're right or left. It's certainly not there, and actually I'm quite grateful it's not there in that regard. But in my experience, most people who go into politics want to do so because they have a vision of the good, going back to where we started, because they want to achieve some good. And very often, by no means all the time, but very often, that is rooted in a deeper metaphysical vision of what is good. So you can't separate the two at a deep level, no matter how much you might want to.
What do you say to the person who thinks, oh, okay, we've got this person who's a Christian and they're a politician, but at least leave their faith behind when they come to do their politics?
I'd say, do you really want a robot in Parliament? That's a slightly facetious thing to say. And I do understand, as you said, the fear that, you know, you elect politicians and not preachers. But that's a bit of a caricature, really. I mean, I would say to the politician who behaves like a preacher, don't. But I would say to the person who asks politicians, let's rephrase the question, to leave their deep commitments, their belief in the good, their desire to change the world, to leave that at the door. Well, if you do that, what's the point of going into politics?
Is there anything that good might come out of someone who's a Christian politician? The public good, like what might someone whose local member is a Christian, what might they imagine they're going to bring to it? What might be something that's positive?
Politicians usually answer that question by saying that they bring a sense of hopefulness into a situation. That can be a bit anodyne sometime, but I suspect that deep motivations of Christian politicians are around the idea that things can change, that we're not programmed in a certain way, that we've always got to, you know, that the future is exactly the same as the past, or we've always got to simply be satisfying our selfish urges. And that there's an understanding of that transformation that can bring a genuine difference and hope to politics.
No one would remember the Good Samaritan if he'd only had good intentions. He had money as well.
Let's talk about your latest book, The Political Samaritan. You've written about the way the very famous parable, The Good Samaritan, has been sometimes co-opted by politicians and used for various purposes. Now, I'm not sure everyone these days knows the story. Can you give us a quick summary of the actual parable that Jesus told? And then we'll get into what it's meant in politics.
So the parable is about a man walking down a street from Jerusalem to Jericho. He gets mugged. The street is slightly misleading. It's out in the countryside. It's out in robber country. Gets mugged. Priest walks by, doesn't help him. Levite, this kind of minor priest, walks by, doesn't help him. Samaritan walks by, does help him, and helps him an awful lot. The context is twofold. Samaritan's not popular amongst Jews in the first century. That's an understatement. But more important context is that this particular story is almost uniquely, I think I'm right in saying, told by Jesus in response to a specific Q&A he's having with a lawyer, a religious lawyer at the time.
And the question is, who is my neighbour?
That's right.
And he gives this story.
Yes.
How have people interpreted it in politics? So politicians, you say, have sometimes used it. I know Margaret Thatcher famously spoke about the fact that, well, at least part of the point was that the Good Samaritan had to be rich enough to be able to help in the first place. She was making a particular point. I know you've talked about Gordon Brown using it to justify bailing out the banks in the financial crisis. So it gets used in lots of different ways.
It really does. It's used on the left and the right. It's used, I looked through the parliamentary records of the British Parliament, it's used for a bewildering different range of topics. Perhaps most interestingly, it's used at some very high levels. It's used by prime ministers and party leaders in major leadership speeches and parliamentary question times. So it's not just kind of simmering at a slightly lower level of British politics. It's everywhere.
But what are some examples then of how this might be used in politics?
Let me give an example from the left, an example from the right. I start with a particular bizarre example from the left. Oh, it must have been 3 or 4 years ago now. Massive parliamentary debate about whether Britain should bomb Syria during the Syrian civil war. Right at the end, a front-bench Labour politician stood up to exhort his party to internationalism and military intervention. And at one point he says, "We have never been a party to walk by on the other side of the road." That is how left-wing politicians almost always refer to it. And in this instance, he was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Okay.
That's a pretty extreme use.
Yeah. And I suppose in the sense of we're trying to protect someone by doing this.
It is exactly to protect somebody. It is used on the left as a cipher for let's do something. Now, you might simply say, well, it's just used to mean let's do something. It doesn't really mean something. But the important thing is it's bringing some ethical weight to this view of let's do something. The problem is that unless you've got a good idea of what it is you are supposed to be doing, let's do something is not usually the most helpful political exhortation. But to make sure I'm politically balanced,
yes,
here, of
please,
course.
Please be.
Picking up Margaret Thatcher, she mainlined the parable in British politics post-war from 1968 onwards, and she used it for twofold reasons. One, as you intimated, for advocating material wealth. No one would remember the Good Samaritan, she said, if he only had good intentions. Mm-hmm. But she also used it to say, I doubt whether, in a speech at the end of the 1970s, social services would have done as much for the man who fell among the thieves as the Good Samaritan did. In other words, she used it to advocate voluntarism rather than state intervention. If the Labour use of the parable to justify bombing Syria is somewhat extreme, the Thatcherite use to justify materialism and voluntarism is also stretching it a bit.
So your sense is that people are, on both sides, are misusing this for purposes that don't really fit necessarily with the parable?
Yes, but that statement is always predicated on what is the real use. If you're accusing someone of misusing it, you've got to have some idea of what using it is, what legitimate use.
Well, let's come to that in a second, but I just want to ask quickly, because I'm interested in this. If I get up and do my political speech today and make this kind of veiled reference to the parable of the Good Samaritan, they're not explaining the whole parable in the way you did earlier, just we don't walk by on the other side of the road. Are people still getting that is a reference to a Bible story or not? Or is that just becomes as part of the language that people understand in a different way?
Really good question. I think they get it a lot less. And that inevitably invites the question, well, is it actually still a biblical statement then? Mm. Is it not simply like various passages from Shakespeare, they just passed into the lifeblood of a language? I think you could argue that, except for the fact that it is used in such a high-profile way. Political speech is very carefully measured and filtered today, and politicians, by and large, are not allowed by their advisers to say things that are accidental. I think the advantage of this particular parable is, you know, to quote a phrase from Scripture, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Mm-hmm. It's there for people who recognise it. Those who don't aren't going to be bothered by it. Those who do hear the reference pick up something of the ethical weight and urgency behind it. So, if you like, it's a successful way of larding your speech with some ethical seriousness without risking the accusation of ramming it down our throats.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Nick Spencer's latest book is The Political Samaritan, How Power Hijacked a Parable. So we had to ask him, what's a more accurate reading of this parable? What does it mean when it's not hijacked?
Imagine a circle, your hermeneutical circle, your circle of interpretation, and you can draw it really tightly or really broadly. A really tight reading of the parable is that this is a halakha debate. Halakha, first century Jewish legal debate about how you interpret the law. That's why the context of the conversation with the lawyer is so important. And what we're seeing here is a debate about whether it is appropriate to save a life or to maintain ritual purity. And that's the key thing about it. It's a priest and a Levite. They are required to remain ritually pure. That even means not touching, not going near a body that might be dead. And interestingly, the only time in Scripture the word we translate as half dead is used to describe the man. In other words, Jesus is deliberately saying, you don't know if this man's dead or not. Don't know if you're going to get ritually impure. So weigh that command, you must remain ritually pure, with the equal command of safe life. It's like Jesus' encounter healing with a man with a paralyzed arm on a Sabbath. Is it right to heal or not? Very, very tight, specific definition, interpretation. More broadly than that, this is interpretation. This is a parable about the extent to which you do or don't cross ethnic and religious lines. This is not an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotchman, as we expect. In other words, it's not a priest, a Levite, and an ordinary Jewish layperson. It's a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan. Samaritans have the law, but their understanding of it is vilified by Jews in the first century. But that isn't a barrier to the fact that he is helping somebody. So it's a question about who's my neighbour. Don't let your ethnic and religious divisions preclude answering that question in a way generously. But if I can beg your attention slightly longer, it's also a question about action. The lawyer asks, who is my neighbour? And Jesus sends him away by saying, go and do likewise. In other words, stop morally passing the world, go and act in it. But also, sorry, finally, it's such a rich parable. The lawyer asks, who is my neighbour? And fascinatingly, Jesus responds, who was the neighbour to the man in distress? In other words, he begins by saying, I am a moral agent, and I give my moral action to those who I deem right or not. Other people are neighbours. By the end of the parable, the neighbour becomes the moral agent who is acting or otherwise. So Jesus is implicitly saying there, it's not all about who you can give to, it's about who you're prepared to receive from.
You're right. It's an incredibly rich story, isn't it? And it clearly has, and the uses of it in various places have reflected this. It really is a powerful story, isn't it? It gets to people. There's something very human about this that people respond to.
It really is. I think this is one of the beauties of stories. And in actual fact, you can expand this beyond Scripture. But it's remarkable about how many stories within the Scriptures, and in specifically how many stories that Jesus told, are not just quote-unquote mere stories. It's almost as if they touch the nerve about what it is to be a human. years ago, I did some research for an organisation I worked for before, Theos, about faith and doubt in Britain today amongst non-Christians, non-believers, sometimes very, very hostile ones. They had no problem with putting the boot into Christianity and no problem putting the boot into the church and even individual Christians. But fascinatingly, even these people who were amongst the most hostile I've ever spoken to didn't have a bad word for Jesus. It was a real eye-opener for me that, if you like, no matter how bad the public presence of Christianity is or how unfairly it is judged, Jesus cuts through that remarkably.
In writing the book, though, what were you hoping to achieve? Was it just sort of resurrecting the right interpretation of this parable, or what was, you know, behind it? What motivated you?
It's a few things, really. It was partly just drawing attention to this remarkable fact of the parable being used. It's drawing attention to what that, does that mean about our public oratory and discourse? What does that mean about religion today? But also, really fascinating, what does this mean about the legitimacy of certain public discourse? What I mean by that is that that idea today is mostly governed by the philosophy of John Rawls, who argued that if you're in a position of political authority over people, it is incumbent on you to use reasonable public language, the kind of thing that reasonable people agree with. That means don't talk God too much, effectively. Fascinatingly, in one of Rawls' late essays, when he is refining and justifying this position, he uses the example of the parable of the Good Samaritan, in effect to say that whilst you can introduce it into public discourse, you can only do so if it's chaperoned by proper, reasonable political language, because the danger otherwise is that you're disrespecting the people over whom you're governing and you risk fragmenting public discourse. Well, it is used. It's used regularly. It's used in very prominent political situations, and it hasn't fragmented public discourse. And it's not an example of political leaders disrespecting the electorate. So it's a way of saying this whole very familiar contemporary idea that you don't do God in politics, we have way overplayed it. In theory, it makes a lot of sense. As I said, politicians shouldn't be preaching at the electorate. But we are way too overcautious, and the use of the parable of the Good Samaritan so frequently and to such effect shows that we should be more welcoming of Scripture and indeed other rich, comprehensive moral doctrines, as Rawls would call them, other rich sources into public debate. That's what makes them interesting and engaging.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore.
We have more from Nick Spencer coming up on the podcast, so stay tuned, subscribe so you don't miss anything. Just type Life and Faith in the search box of your podcast app to find us.
Next week,
the beef I have with Steven Pinker is that he traces all good things to the Enlightenment and no bad things to it. And as soon as you do that, I think you're almost invariably oversimplifying history for your own purposes.